Alex Renneman with Heads Up, and today with me is John Saldana. John is the Sears Chair in Global Supply Chain Management at the Chambers College of Business at WVU. John, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, Alex. Happy to be here.
For sure. I'd love to hear just a little bit, before we get into some of the issues that we're going to talk about, a little bit about your background and your expertise related to supply chain management, ports, global commerce, and the like.
I have a background in all of those things, unfortunately. So I started off my career in the Merchant Marine. I spent 10 years as a navigator. Thanks to my own family and my wife's family background in the Merchant Marine, we both convinced each other that leaving early was good. So I left the Merchant Marine before I got my captain's endorsement and command. And so I joined school at Penn State, got my graduate degree. And so having seen the other side of shipping on the actual, what I would call the trenches of global supply chain management, that's where my research has been. My research has primarily been in helping companies figure out their networks and their optimal operational strategies for global supply chain networks. I work primarily with large global Fortune 50, Fortune 500 companies with their different manufacturing sourcing operations.
That's perfect. So, John, it's interesting, this industry you're in and even the industry, I mean, you know, supply chain for years was never really a topic of conversation in households, and COVID hits and all kinds of things. And then you see barges or giant ships stuck in the canal and all these things. So these have become kind of household topics. But I think we all are participants in the supply chain, even if we're just consumers. But understanding what's really happening there, it's a bit of a mystery. So I'm excited to talk to you a little bit about the importance of those parts of the supply chain, ultimately what's happening, some of the strategic ramifications, and then ultimately some of the things that we can do as leaders in our organizations to flow, ebb and flow with the challenges that come with these things. So let's start right off the bat just with canals and ports. And, you know, why are canals like the Panama and the Suez Canal so crucial to global trade?
Let me first lay the stage by talking about what is a supply chain network. The supply chain network is nothing but an interlinked group of nodes that are connected by what we would call edges. They are simply straight lines that connect those nodes. And those straight lines are usually transportation networks. If you look at it globally, you have these transportation networks that link suppliers that bring in supplies from Asia, Europe, Africa, into North America, where those raw materials, commodities, subcomponents, subassemblies are transformed into final products. Sometimes we have final products that are brought in. Now, at every one of these so-called links, you might have certain characteristics. So if you think about why the Panama Canal exists, the Panama Canal exists where otherwise ships would have to go all the way around the Cape, South America, to get to North America. That's cutting a significant portion of time off those trips and allowing ships to come in through the Panama Canal and get into from the Pacific to the east coast of North America. So that considerable advantage that is provided by the Panama Canal makes it such a critical route. Similarly with the Suez Canal, without the Suez Canal, ships would have to traverse all the way around the southern tip of Africa. And that's the actual route taken by the original European Portuguese sailors that came to Asia and came to the East. So without the Suez Canal, you would have to, and now many companies are actually rerouting, carriers are rerouting their ships because of the Houthi attacks. And of course, last year with the Evergreen ships blocking of the canal, you had that same strategy have to be deployed because commerce still has to flow. So that's what makes these canals so critical. It saves considerable amount of time and money for global commerce, which really brings us together in this global village for manufacturing and markets.
Man, that's a great overview. And you know, you mentioned the Houthis, you mentioned challenges in the Panama Canal. And we're going to get to those, but so those are two big canals that we know of. But I'd love to talk a little bit. Like I've heard, that there's been maybe this proposed Nicaraguan Canal, and there's other challenges. What other alternatives? And you mentioned alternative routes clear around the Cape or trains. Well, talk a little bit about some of those alternatives. How real are they? because I guess that puts to weight of how critical these canals really are, even from a strategic standpoint.
Absolutely. I mean, there's been, for example, going across the Arctic Sea, going through the Northern Passage, through the north of Europe and Russia. You have that Northern Passage, and especially with climate change, we see a lot of the ice pack changing. And so that ice pack, even before climate change, there were various projects that explored the use of using ice cutting freighters to get through, and also with ice breaking ships that could lead a path through the Northern Passage from Asia and into North America and Northern Europe. So that is one feasible solution. The other feasible solution that has been explored a lot, of course, is land bridges. So land bridges are essentially a way in which instead of an entire ship going through a canal, you'd actually have a ship, for example, come into Seattle or Oakland, and then offload the cargo onto a train, and the train goes all the way across the continent of North America to the East Coast, that gets put on a ship again and continues its journey to Europe. There are land bridge options for Asia. Of course, now with Russia and the conflict, that is obviously off the table, but there is a Trans-Siberian Railway that has been explored between China and Northern Europe. But North America, there's been land bridge options that have been floated. Mexico also is another option where you can bring freight in from Asia into Mexico and maybe cut across North America to the southern East Coast ports or some of the mid-Atlantic East Coast ports to be put onto freighters that go back across to Europe. So there's been options like that that have been floated. The Nicaraguan Canal, again, I mean, if you think about when the Panama Canal and the Suez Canal were built, the environmental feasibility itself was so, there was no environmental feasibility then. The environmental feasibility to do a project like that today is going to be so complex. I mean, take the Hoover Dam, for example. The Hoover Dam probably would not be built today because of the environmental impact of what was took to build the dam. But so today, those kinds of projects, unless an entire government, and even the government, you need to have so many, outside capital investments. It's going to be really hard, in my opinion, to be able to see those come to fruition.
Yeah, just that little bit of you traveling around the world with what these things are, it shows how geopolitical things happening. You talk about the conflict with Russia and Ukraine, and it just is really massive how complex things can be when certain parts of the world, either through geopolitical issues or disasters from a natural perspective, and even talking about, like, for instance, I did not know when looking at the when kind of digging into this when things started kind of hitting the news a little bit and certain supply chain starts getting crunched with some things down in the Panama Canal. I guess maybe I learned it as a young man. I don't know, but I didn't know you actually had to go up into a lake and then back down from both sides. I knew obviously how canals work, but I didn't realize we're climbing up and going down, and that's where the drought comes in. I'd love to talk a little more and have you expand some on what is the impact from natural and man-made disasters. Really, maybe just kind of talk about the Panama Canal. What's really going on there?
So, I mean, climate change clearly is affecting rainfall and affecting precipitation. And of course, as we grow as a world population and encroaching on water bodies, I mean, water is one of the most precious commodity going into the future, right? We need it for so many different things. You just mentioned transportation. I mean, why go to the Panama Canal? Here, right to our north, we have the St. Lawrence Seaway, which is getting more and more important. I mean, if you think about the amount of freight that goes into and out of Canada and along our northern border with Canada, it's tremendous. Going into the Great Lakes, Lake Superior, Duluth especially, you have a lot of that freight. So coming back to the Panama Canal, funny story, I've got a great picture of my dad and me as a 2-year-old child sitting on the ship as he was piloting a ship through the Panama Canal. So I bring that up in
Oh,
my classes because that's, you kind of see the tugs pulling the ship, and you kind of, as a layperson, you wonder, why are these locks over there? And then, you can point to the lock, for example, just across from the West Virginia University, the Marriott Hotel, and you can see, all right, there is a the rivers are flowing, and the rivers generally tend to flow downstream, down the, on this incline. And for ships to generally go up to go up an incline, it's going to take a lot of power, and also you cannot control the flow of the water, right? And that causes a lot of problems navigationally for ships. So as a result, you have these series of locks that you need to have ships go through in order to step the ship up to the point where you hit the lake, and then from the after you navigate the lake, then go down. Now, what you're talking about with water levels, you have the recent expansion of the Panama Canal to allow these so-called Panamax ships, right? These are large 13,000 TEU ships. Again, container shipping is really the engine that drives our world economy. Everything from the shirts you and I are wearing to the electronics that we have on our heads, everything virtually comes by a ship somewhere from Asia or Europe into North America. And so, without these container ships, we cannot conduct commerce as we are come to get used to in our modern day lives. So if you think about all these Panamax ships that were created in mind to maximize the entire capacity of the Panama Canal, they were designed with the width in mind. And also, when you have the width, you also have the depth, right? Because you can only load up to a certain depth. Now, the width is manageable because the Panama Canal Authority has created the Panama Canal, which is a fixed width to accommodate those ships. However, with drought conditions and with the decrease in the lake levels, which is used for multiple purposes, including shipping, now you're seeing a factor where the draft is going to be reduced, and that is going to impact how much shipping can go through. So you actually have ports on either side that would potentially allow ships to offload some of their cargo, lighten up, and go through in case you have problems with drafts. And you know, if you think about drafts, there are so many factors that can affect it. The tides can affect it. You can affect it in terms of the silting, banks, shoals, you know, as they build up. And these are all fresh water, so you have to think about, you know, the fresh water is coming in from some sort of from some, you know, natural source, which is also bringing silt into it, and that constantly has to be tended and has to be kept up because of dredging. So, you know, these are factors that are dynamic and will constantly be changing, especially in our, you know, in our current conditions of climate change.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite fascinating when you dig into that. And so I know a lot of your study and work have been around, you know, the human impact on some of these things. And so obviously you could argue that's natural, but you could argue, hey, well, we placed it and we planned around it has a human impact. But you look directly over, you know, at the Suez Canal, and there's some real human intervention going on with the Houthis. Help us kind of understand what's happening there and how that's impacting trade globally over there as well.
I don't know if our viewers, listeners, or you are familiar with the story of Captain Phillips. It's a great movie. I love it. It's one of my favorite movies. Probably the most accurate representation of merchant marine life and
Really?
pirate attacks. If you think about how things started with the Somali pirates, again, a geopolitical issue. You have an entire population that is affected by some sort of economic disparity, and their livelihoods have been taken away. In the case of the Somalis, you have, you know, global fishing fleets, especially those from East Asia, that came in and overfished, and then these subsistence fishermen had nothing else to do, and so they formed these bands to essentially go out and pirate ships. And they made lots of money in the beginning until the world saw and sort of placed their global fleets there. Now, if you go to the Houthis, it's a completely different geopolitical issue. It's now something where they are trying to raise awareness of the situation in Palestine, showing solidarity, and they're using the same tactics. The tactics is, you know, we are going to disrupt shipping. They look at shipping as sort of the lifeblood of what you know, what sustains our lifestyles in many Western industrialized countries, and also sustains the economies in the East. And as a result of that, they can bring, you know, attention to the entire world from these acts. So essentially, you know, just going out and disrupting shipping has now caused significant cost. I mean, of course, insurance is going to go up. in the immediate aftermath. The cost of shipping is going to go up as many carriers have chosen to go around the Cape of Good Hope instead of going through the Suez Canal. And that is affecting lead times. When you think about lead times, what's going to be affected is the time to the customer. And since companies are not interested in increasing the amount of time, they're going to lose a competitive advantage, so they have to build up inventories. Building up inventories requires an additional investment in capital. You have to borrow, your borrowing costs are going to go up. And as a result of which, you might have to have additional warehousing. You might have to have, so your operational costs are going to go up. You're going to see an increase in capital costs, increase in borrowing costs. And all of these costs are going to add up. And then you have two options as a company. I'm going to be a competitive advantage and pass on and swallow this cost in the short term to gain that market share. I'm going to pass on that cost to my customer if my customer is going to stay with me. So those are the kinds of things you have as options for leaders instead of situations like this. But these situations are not unique. I mean, unfortunately or fortunately, we can look back to history and we can say, okay, this is what happened here. These are the options we have. And essentially, it boils down, Alex, to really a cost. And who and how are we going to absorb that cost? And how do we pass it on to the consumer?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, the challenge of what we do, I mean, it's coming. And most of us, most of the subscribers of me included listening right now, we can't really impact what's happening over there. We don't have that kind of political clout or whatever it is. But it affects us and we got to figure out how to deal with that. And I want to get to that. But before I do, timing wise, we had this scheduled. We're just a little over 24 hours from the Key Bridge in Baltimore collapsing due to the ship crashing into that. And I just want to point out to this, obviously, we're not supply chain robots. We understand the human impact there and our hearts go out to all of involved and everything. However, there is, we are talking about supply chain and there's an impact here again, because here is a shipping lane that is now, has a bridge across and recovery efforts going on. So help us understand about what is that? We're talking about this global side, but now it's something a little more local, a little more regional, but it has huge impacts, right?
Absolutely, Alex. Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I was watching in horror to see the human, the human tragedy. And of course, the human tragedy on the bridge and the workers that were lost is unspeakable. But there's also, we will all see in the news in the next subsequent weeks and months the human tragedy in terms of the lives of the sailors that impacted. Because that's a massive thing. The pilot and the sailors, they are the ones who were directly involved in the precipitation of this. So, my as a past and a current merchant mariner, my hearts go out to them as well for this unfortunate accident. But obviously, as a supply chain expert, the hat comes on immediately, and I think about, okay, what does this mean in terms of supply chain? So the first thing is container shipping. I mean, we just talked about container shipping, how it drives the world economy. One, if there is a silver lining, Baltimore is not a big container port. It's about a quarter of the size of the ports of New York and New Jersey. So if you take, that entire Hudson River entrance, the Port Elizabeth, it's about a quarter of that size. And we are not in the peak season right now. Peak shipping season will start, late May, mid-May to about, August and September. That's when you see the rush for the back to school, all of the holidays, et cetera. So that's when you're going to start seeing all of those orders hit our coast. So we have sufficient capacity to divert those carriers to other ports up and down the East Coast. Obviously, you have Baltimore, Port Elizabeth, you have Savannah, Charleston, Norfolk. You can absorb that additional capacity. That's a good thing. On the automobile side, clearly, the one statistic that pops up on the news chyrons everywhere is that, you have 850,000 plus automobiles coming in through the port of Baltimore. One, again, another silver lining is, and it's I don't know how much of it was chance, how much of it was planned, but you have the Trade Point Atlantic terminals that are there on the western side of the port. So that has berths for automobile roll-on, roll-off ships, for vehicle traffic to roll on, roll off those ships. So I think carriers have already talked about the fact that they have alternate arrangements, and that that Trade Point Atlantic terminals allows that. And so even there's some break bulk, so even the agriculture products can be loaded, unloaded over there without having to go through the Key Bridge. The Key Bridge that has blocked the channel. So on those two, automotive and container, Baltimore should probably be up and at least the region on the East Coast should be okay. What was something that's concerning me and I haven't seen a lot about is the fact that Baltimore is now, I think it's the second largest, probably about 20% or fifth of all coal exports come in are exported from Baltimore, and that's a big, that's a massive export, portfolio. Of course, you have the ports of Norfolk that are the leader, but now you have to think about, can I get a rail carrier to move or divert my coal shipments to Norfolk? Can I get my ocean carrier to actually find berthing and to get berths in Norfolk? And can I actually put my cargoes there? Is there enough of stacking capacity over there? In the meantime, you have coal operators over here who might have to slow down in terms of their operational extraction and might have to, inventory a lot more of their raw and finished coal and may have to, put additional coal on barges and store those, use those barges as mobile warehouses to keep those coal, if they don't want to slow down the operational extraction. So you have the coal as well that, is something that I haven't seen a lot of, but I'm pretty sure, especially in West Virginia, we're going to see impacts in our region on coal operators who use the Port of Baltimore as an export portal.
Yeah, I would expect, well, it's shades of the pandemic to see barges or oil tankers holding stuff waiting. That's shades of that. And I'll tell you, you mentioned the word going back to the bridge collapsing, and we've all seen the video. It is horrifying, and it feels helpless. And most of what we've talked about today here, there are all kinds of things. I the first same thing you did. I immediately thought of the human tragedy that that is. Then I immediately thought of, well, what does this do supply chain wise? And then I also think, oh my gosh, it's the risk we have in these areas for this to duplicate. Or I was just shocked how quickly the bridge fell. And we're not structural engineers and here to have a conversation, but it did kind of really help. I felt somewhat like helpless. Like here's something I can't really impact positively. And I guess it kind of goes to the rest of this conversation. Most everything we've talked about today, most of the listeners right now have no influence or direct management over decisions are made about route, if there's this problem, another route, but we're going to have to consume the costs of that and the delays and such, what you mentioned earlier. So I'd love to spend a little bit of time now, whether it's, we've got folks who are listening that are managing warehouses and in manufacturing plants, and they're making operational decisions and trying to figure out how to respond to these things. What strategies can supply chain leaders employ to enhance resilience against these kinds of disasters, whether they be natural or man-made?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I've been looking through the research for the last, I've been doing research in port disruptions for now over 2 decades, and I've been looking into this research for a long time. And the truth of the matter is that the thing that you keep coming up with in the research is resiliency, just like you said. What I see, is to contrast with resiliency is that our supply chains have been leaned out. And when you think about leaning out, what you're doing is you're removing cost. But when you're removing cost, what you're doing is you're removing assets, you're removing warehousing facilities, you're removing people capability, you're adding some mechanization, but mechanization is not a fungible item. It's very fixed. You have a sunk cost in machinery, and so that allows you to do one thing really well. So economies of scale are really driving the leanness in our system. So what I think what we have to do is instead of talking about brittle supply, and these supply chains are very brittle. And we've seen brittle supply chains, with the tsunami in Japan, which disrupted automotive supply chains, the port lockouts in 2001, which basically brought the economy to a halt, and many automotive supply chains were losing money every hour. What those lessons taught us is that instead of leanness, and that led to brittleness with these so-called black swan events. I mean, I say so-called because they seem to be more and more common now. What we have to do is we have to build a little bit more rigidity into us, not rigidity, but resiliency in our supply chain. And that can take different forms for different types of supply chains. We started by talking about, you know, the Suez Canal and the Panama Canal as the two major thoroughfares that are choke points and control all of the global shipping around the world. And when you think about the fact that, you know, I'll give you a simple example. If I'm a retailer, and I'm a medium-sized retailer. I worked at Ohio State for, you know, for 8, 9 years, and I saw many, you know, many garment retailers in that area. And if I'm thinking about launching my spring season planogram, right, I have this layout for all of the clothes that are going to be displayed in my store, and that's going to come live at the end of March. And I have one critical shipment from a supplier in Vietnam that has this particular garment in this style, this T-shirt style and this pant style that has to be in this particular place. So customers, when they come into the store, they're attracted to that low cost, fashionable item, but they'll also spend time looking at other things. So it's a critical part of my retail strategy. Now, if I work with this one supplier and they give me the entire shipment on this one ship that then gets stuck in the Panama Canal for some reason or the other, guess what happens to my whole launch strategy, right? So when we think about that, that's a very, very brittle supply chain. So what could be a better option? You obviously have to build some sort of contingency planning in this. And usually contingencies involve some sort of replication or some sort of duplicity. So with duplicity, you have, okay, I don't want to put all my eggs in one basket. Maybe we can ship some of these items by air and have a minimum requirement for every single store in our main regions, and then ship the bulk by ocean and have it maybe on two or three different. And because why do I want to put everything in one 40-foot container? Because it costs much less per unit. But if I distribute this load onto, you know, three or four different less than container load shipments, it's going to cost me a little bit more. But then the flip side of that is if that one container gets stuck somewhere, then that's not going to prevent me from launching my entire spring season for this particular retail chain, this garment chain. So that's the kind of thinking that we need to have is, you know, we have the just-in-time thinking. There's also the just-in-case thinking. Okay, what can go wrong? So as a supply chain leader, you know, nobody can predict. I mean, nobody. I was woken up by my friends and family who are all merchant mariners at 4:30 in the morning saying, have you seen what's going on TV? And nowhere in my wildest dreams and talking to other professionals, nobody ever believed or imagined that this something like this could happen. I mean, to think about the fact that you could have a generator failure, and there are so many factors that could lead to a generator failure, right? The generator failure in a port with a bridge that is, you know, that is fairly old, over 50 years old, and that doesn't have the right protections for an event like this, like other bridges in the United States have. Right, to have that unique of an event, if you think about the number of chains of items that need to go wrong, and you have the tide at that right point to push the ship while it is lost power towards this particular pylon, right? I mean, the variables in that are so small, the probability in that is so small, it still happened. We call it a black swan event, but with the volume of our supply chain activity, we're going to see many more events like this happening. So as supply chain professionals, we have to think about everything that can go wrong. If I put all my eggs in one basket, am I going to lose that basket? And if I lose that basket, what does it do to my strategy? What does it do to my go-to-market strategy? What does it do to my customers' loyalty and my market share? And that's critical. And there's research has shown that when there is a supply chain disruption, you can see a 13% or even a 15% reduce, and that's average, reduction in your share and your stock prices. And that can last for up to a year or 2 years after the disruption.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I think for we've all seen organizations that treat their supply chain like the redheaded stepchild, if you will, that old analogy. I don't see a whole lot of that anymore. They see the strategic nature of it because it does impact so many things in their organization. And you make a good point when you talk about how this whole just-in-time thing. I remember when COVID hit first, one of the first things, obviously you have the human piece and all that, but from a supply chain perspective, I'm like, Our Justin Thompson could come back and bite us in the rear end on this one. And it did in many cases. And then you see ships sideways in the canal. And I mean, it just, wow, what a lesson. And it, but again, we are always looking for, if there's one thing that just has continually been put on supply chain leaders is do more with less. Here's extra cost, but I don't want to have to pass this on to our customers. And we've seen inflation, but there's only the elasticity demand is only so much. In some markets, you got competitors out there. So it's a really brutal moment for many of those leaders. And I think it's a great suggestion to balance that just in time with just in case. But I know with some of our customers and partners throughout the globe, we work with them around bringing technology into their work execution area and ways to try to squeeze out a little extra cost, to try to gain a little more efficiency, a little more accuracy. Can technology help us here as well? And how have you seen that working from a supply chain perspective?
That's a great question. So yeah, we're working with some companies right now, and AI is a great tool for that. AI is a great aggregation tool for that, and it's a great tool for being able to predict using predictive analytics. So using weather data to look at what are precipitation levels in the Panama region, for example, and how is that going to affect, you know, how is that going to affect the conditions for drafts, for vessel drafts, and for the water levels in the Panama Canal that can affect, you know, the continuation of shipping through the Panama Canal. Then also there's you know, how for agricultural companies, you know, how does rainfall affect the output? And for the customers of those agricultural companies, you know, you have corn that gets transformed into ethanol, into sugar, into all these other commodities. So how does that now affect my pricing for commodities, right? And then how can those inputs then affect my own productivity and my cost and my margins that I can make in the market? So AI is definitely a tool, and AI obviously requires data. And when you have information, you know, you have access to a lot of data of different types. Another way in which you can use information, I mean, this is sort of a principle that we teach in our classrooms every day, is information can take the place of inventory. If I can improve my predictive ability a little bit better, you know, I can definitely improve my response time to the market. I can improve my response time to individual customers, and I can now, you know, I can now use analytics and AI to determine who are my most profitable customers, and then focus my efforts on creating better relationships with them so that we can share information in a way. I mean, the obvious ways are VMI, where customers and suppliers have worked together to improve that visibility, right? So taking that VMI principle one further, VMI works with individual and with strategic customers and suppliers. You can also use AI in a way to leverage it to be able to go beyond those individual customers and grow your market share, and to even work with smaller customers, smaller suppliers, and see how that can be leveraged to improve your... So information, I mean, there's three drivers, right? I mean, there's information, there's inventory, and facilities. If you have a fixed supply chain, your suppliers, you know who your suppliers are, you know your customers are. Those are the three main drivers. Of course, you have transportation as well. So information, inventory, facilities, transportation, those are your main drivers. And information is the key one, because depending upon information, you can now deploy your assets and your inventories and your transportation networks according to where, you know, your analytics tell you and your information tells you you need to do.
Yeah, that's awesome. John, I'm always been amazed, what seems like such a simple process of raw materials to manufacturing to supply to, you know, and to the end customer is so complex across the globe, and so many things impacted. And many of us, and like I mentioned before, many of our listeners today are people not necessarily on a lot of decision-making. What happens, of course, there's many things happen, again, geopolitically or naturally that we can't really control, but we have to engage. We have to respond to those. So I appreciate what you've brought to us here today. And, you know, I'm hopeful that we continue to see some of the technology, some of the maturing of AI be a real tool for us in this industry and beyond. But I tell you, John, again, I really appreciate you coming on the program, and, you know, hopefully we'll get to maybe bring you back on again, maybe not in light of another disaster. Maybe there's some kind of other opportunity or stuff that we can bring you on and have you share with us your expertise.
I appreciate the opportunity, Alex. Thank you. And yeah, I'd love to come back under happier circumstances, maybe to talk about a successful holiday season and rollout of maybe a new technology. That'll be awesome. Or talk about, how AI is improving our lives.
That's right. Awesome. Well, John Sadama, Sears Chair in Global Supply Chain Management at Chambers College of Business at WVU. Thanks again for coming on the program, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you, Alex. It was my pleasure.